rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Welcome back, my friend. 6 minutes past the hour. It's, what is it, Tuesday today? January, just about gone here, the 30th of January. Tom Hartman with you. In an executive order published last week in the Federal Register, this is Bush creating legislation on the fly. I mean, tell me what's wrong with this picture. Well, actually, you probably don't have to. You probably already get what's wrong with this picture. And the founders and framers, the founders of this country and the framers of the Constitution had this very clear vision of three branches of government that were co-equal. Now, the first among equals was the one that was the most responsive to the people. That is Congress. It's directly elected by us. The second among equals was the presidency. It's not directly elected by us. It was elected by a council of wise elders who were selected by the states. And in the early days, the states could select that council of wise elders, otherwise known as the Electoral College, any way they wanted. This was based on the old Saxton, prior to the Norman invasion, prior to 1099 in England, based on the way the Saxton kings were picked in what is now the British Isles. This goes back to the old Whig histories that Jefferson was so fond of. So the second among equals the president, and the third among equals the Supreme Court, which we borrowed in large part, not just from the court system of England, but also from the Iroquois Confederacy. Interestingly, though, among the Iroquois, only women could be on the court. But nonetheless, the idea was that the laws would be made by the legislative branch representing the will of the people. And then there had to be another branch of government that was also the servant of the people that would make sure that the laws were executed. In other words, that would carry out the will of the legislature, that would run the police forces, that would be the commander in chief of the army, that would see to it that the nation was defended, that would put into place any agencies the government that the legislature decides to put into place, in order to do those core things that are enumerated, those six core items that are listed in the preamble to the Constitution of the United States, to establish justice, to form a more perfect union, to ensure domestic tranquility, to provide for the common defense, to promote the general welfare, and to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and to our posterity. Well, I would suggest that we're seeing the antithesis of this now. It's a headlong rush, just an absolute headlong rush. And one that frankly has some significant dangers associated with it. You know, Umberto Eco came up with his 14, he called it fascism, eternal fascism, 14 dimensions of it. 14 Ways of Looking at a Black Shirt by Umberto Eco. He says the first feature of Ur-Fascism is a cult of tradition. By the way, Chris Hedges has a new book called American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. I just spent about a half hour with him. He's brilliant. In fact, he was on this program last week. Brilliant guy. Graduate of the Harvard Divinity School. And he and I both identify ourselves as Christians and are both horrified by these guys. I call them Christianists. Very, very different thing. And that's what George Bush is about. Number one, a cult of tradition. 14 elements of fascism. Number two, traditionalism implies rejection of modernism. Number three, irrationalism also depends on the cult of action for action's sake. See, I'm telling you, this is what we're seeing in what is happening with the executive order published last week in the Federal Register. This is where I started, actually, with this thing, and I'm going to come back to it, I promise. Is this story in the New York Times today by Robert Pear about how George Bush has decided to increase the power that he as president has over whether or not he's going to enforce any laws that Congress makes, over whether or not the regulatory agencies that Congress brings into being are going to do the things that he wants or not, rather than what Congress wants. Number four, in Umberto Eco's 14 Points of Fascism, Ur-Fascism, the critical spirit makes distinctions, and to distinguish is a sign of modernism. Number five, besides, disagreement is a sign of diversity. He says, Ur-fascism grows up and seeks consensus by exploiting and exacerbating the natural fear of difference. The first appeal of a fascist or prematurely fascist movement is an appeal against the intruders. Thus, Ur-fascism is racist by definition. A little off the topic here, but a good point. Number six, Ur-fascism derives from individual or social frustration. I would submit to you that one of the reasons that Bush feels that he can grab power like this is because there is widespread fear in the United States. There is a sense of a feeling of disconnect. 26 years of a conservative war on the middle class in America, declared by Ronald Reagan in 1981, kicked it off by firing the PATCO, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Association, the PATCO workers. And it just went, it's gone downhill ever since then. From free trade agreements to the 1986 amnesty for illegal aliens to the continuous increase in the labor force, thus driving down the cost of labor. Alan Greenspan, 1997, telling the Wall Street Journal that he felt that one of his jobs as chairman of the Fed was to maintain a certain minimum level of worker insecurity. That insecurity is played on very, very adequately by the demagogues. And it's one of the reasons, I think, frankly, that many Americans are willing to allow, tragically, but willing to allow Bush to grab as much power as he wants. Number seven from Umberto Eco. To people who feel deprived of a clear social identity, Ur-fascism says that their only privilege is the most common one, to be born in the same country. It's all about the nation, right? Number eight, the followers must be feel humiliated by the ostentatious wealth and force of their enemies. You ever hear the cons talk about the liberal elites, the limousine liberals? This is fascist talk. Number nine, for Ur-fascism, there's no struggle for life, but rather life is lived for struggle. Forget about peace. Forget about those high words of Dwight Eisenhower and Jack Kennedy about peace. Let's bring peace to the world. No. It's about struggle.
We're going to get the guys who did this to us.
Consider for a moment Michael Wiener. Michael Wiener is a talk show host in San Francisco, nationally syndicated. He goes by the name Michael Savage. Taking on Bernie Sanders. This is just a great example of what I'm talking about here.
So this guy Saunders goes up, Bernie Sanders goes, Saunders is it or Sanders? What is his name? He's a complete and total lunatic. So here's Vermont Socialist Senator Bernie Sanders, the commie from Brooklyn, and a voice on him like, this guy was like a ward chairman for a Democrat in the 1930s, he sounds like, or an ILGW low-level hack. He sounds like he could have been like Barbara Boxer's father. Listen to clip one.
We have got to address the reality in the United States today, we have by far the most unfair distribution of wealth and income of any major industrialized
country.
Kiss
my behind, you
and
psycho.
That we have
screw
a moral
you jealous loser.
That growing gap between the rich and the poor.
You get this? You get this? This is a talk show host. I mean, this is the worldview of these frankly terrified conservatives in America, and they're being whipped into more and more fear by these modern day Father Coughlins, who are well, here, just a few more seconds of it.
Go to hell. How's that? Go to hell. I worked all my life for what I have, and you'll have to kill me to get it from me, you rat. Listen to this dirty socialist in clip two.
How often do we hear people say, USA, number one? And I share that sentiment. Unfortunately, in terms of childhood poverty within the industrialized world, we are also number one. And that
go to hell.
Not
how about going to hell?
One.
Get out. Get him off my headphones.
Yeah, you see, you get the point here. It's all about me. It's not about us. This is the fundamental difference between the conservative and the fascist worldview, frankly, and the progressive or liberal worldview on which this country was founded. The founders of this country believed it's all about the community. It's all about us together. We are a nation of barn builders. And to say, oh, you know, it's all mine. No, I'm sorry. You're the product of a public education system. You didn't die of cholera because we collectively chlorinated your water. I mean, we are a society here. 16 minutes past the hour.
Hello, good evening. Welcome to the 6 o'clock news.
At 6 o'clock.
President Bush's surprise message. America is addicted to...
The hour at the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where being progressive, truly progressive, never felt so good. In an executive order published last week in the Federal Register, this is by Robert Parrott, today's New York Times, Mr. Bush said that each agency, these are all the agencies in the executive branch that are created by acts of Congress. In an executive order published last week in the Federal Register, Mr. Bush said that each agency must have a regulatory policy office run by a political appointee to supervise the development of rules and documents providing guidance to regulated industries. So, Congress creates the Environmental Protection Agency, and they say to the big chemical companies, you know, you can't be pouring benzene into the air. Science says that it kills people. And Bush says, wait a minute. You have to have a regulatory policy office, and it will be headed up by somebody that I appoint, a political appointee, a political hack. We'll get some lawyer from, who's a big donor to the Republican Party, put him in charge. And then that person will get to say, nice try, EPA. You appreciate all your science work and the nice efforts of the scientists and people here, but we're just not going to do it. As the New York Times says, the White House will thus have a gatekeeper. This is like the seizing of absolute power. The White House will thus have a gatekeeper in each agency to analyze the costs and benefits of new rules and to make sure the agencies carry out the president's priorities. And you can bet it's going to be the costs to industries and the benefits to whom? Well, maybe the donors. Maybe the Republican Party. As Robert Pear writes in today's New York Times, this strengthens the hand of the White House in shaping rules that have, in the past, often been generated by civil servants and scientific experts. It suggests that the administration still has ways to exert its power after the takeover of Congress by the Democrats. As Peter Strauss, professor at Columbia Law School, said, this executive order achieves a major increase in White House control over domestic government. Having lost control of Congress, the president is doing what he can to increase his control of the executive branch. Henry Waxman, the Democrat from California and chairman of the Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, is a little more blunt. He says, and I quote, the executive order allows the political staff at the White House to dictate decisions on health and safety issues, even if the government's own impartial experts disagree. This is a terrible way to govern, but great news for special interests. The next sentence in the article from the New York Times, it's a one-sentence paragraph. Business groups hailed the initiative. Hey, what a surprise! Business groups love it! Yes. As Gary D. Bass, executive director of OMB Watch, said, by requiring agencies to show a, quote, market failure, end quote. See, this doesn't have anything to do with the impact on species, on humans, on the future of the planet, on the atmosphere. It's about whether or not it's going to have a problem in the market. By requiring agencies to show a, quote, market failure, end quote, Dr. Bass said, President Bush has created another hurdle for agencies to clear before they can issue rules protecting public health and safety. Wesley P. Warren, this I'm sharing this with you from the New York Times piece here today by Robert Peer. Wesley P. Warren, program director of the National Resources Defense Council, who worked at the White House for 7 years under President Bill Clinton, said, quote, the executive order is a backdoor attempt to prevent EPA from being able to enforce environmental safeguards that keep cancer-causing chemicals and other pollutants out of the air and water. One in three of us is going to die of cancer. That's what the statistics show. If you know anybody right now who has cancer or are concerned about getting it, you might want to send a thank you note or a or the reverse, actually, a how dare you note to the office of the White House. This is incredible. This is absolutely incredible. The Bush administration, the president saying that he has the ability to have the ultimate say over science. He can put a political hack into a regulatory agency, and they will have the final say. A regulatory agency created by we the people, where we collectively, through our elected representatives, said, no, we want to make sure that our food is safe. We want to make sure that our drugs are pure. We want to make sure that our air is breathable. We want to make sure that our water doesn't kill us. We want to make, and Bush can put somebody in each one of these agencies and say, yeah, it doesn't matter. If it has a bad effect on the market, that is to say, if a donor to the Republican Party isn't going to make as much money, we'll just set aside that rule. If this isn't the rise of something close to a proto-fascist form of government, I don't know what is. This is one branch taking over from the other two. This is outrageous. 866-440-8466, our telephone number, 27 minutes past the hour. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception, you know, and they're continuing to do it. I mean, one of the reasons, obviously, why Bush wants to put in this special director regulatory policy office run by a political appointee is so they can keep the news from us. For example, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, Henry Waxman, they're holding hearings looking into political interference in the work of government climate change scientists. And then you go to nationaljournal.com, and this is a reprint over at thinkprogress.org. By press time Monday, documents that were requested, this is Congress asking for documents from executive agencies, right? By press time Monday, documents that were requested as recently as last week and as far back as 6 months ago have not been provided to the committee. Right now, this is the chief of staff, Phil Schillero, for Henry Waxman. Yesterday afternoon, he says, right now, the administration's reaction doesn't make a whole lot of sense. We've been trying to get information that we believe the committee should have for 6 months now. We don't understand why it hasn't been provided. This isn't top secret information. Well, I'll tell you why you're not getting it, Mr. Schillero. You're not getting it because Bush doesn't want the American people to know what he and his cronies and his buddies are up to. I mean, this is Duke Cunningham writ large. It's just that Duke Cunningham did it stupidly. And Bush is doing it smart. It's all about helping out the campaign donors, and even worse, frankly, because Cunningham, you know, he was just a small-time crook. It's also all about seizing as much political power as you can. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. Nancy in Everett, Washington. Hey, Nancy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. There's a dichotomy that seems to be in play that feeds Americans confusion over peoples of other countries.
Mm-hmm.
First, you've got Sting, who sings the song, I Hope the Russians Love Their Children Too, which kind of gives you the, you know, the feeling that we're all in this together.
Right.
And then you've got Dick Cheney, who claims to love his grandchildren, and yet he oversees policies that are detrimental to the society at large. And so, you know, if you can't trust the people that are running your own government, how can you believe that someone in another country is going to have your best interest at heart?
Well,
and so what it,
yeah,
I'm sorry?
That's a good question. I mean, it's like, it's the creation of the other.
Right.
That's the essence. Nancy, thank you for raising that. That is the essence of the whole fascist mentality, is to create the other, to ridicule an other, to create the other, and also to ridicule the idea that we are in it together. Again, Michael Wiener.
Now we have a childhood poverty.
Making fun of childhood poverty, right?
Now we have a childhood poverty. Listen to Bernie Sanders, socialist bum, in clip three.
In 1999, the British government, 6 years later, child poverty in the United Kingdom had been cut by 20%. Similar progress, as I understand it, has been made in Ireland.
So they've cured child poverty in the UK by what? Giving houses to Muslim immigrants? And teaching the children how to set off a suicide bomb on an underground as the poverty's over.
So you get the agenda here. You get how these kinds of things are being handled. I mean, this is tragic. This is un-American and tragic. Mary, driving in California. Hey, Mary, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I was listening to you and the things that Bush is doing here lately, the executive orders and things, and What I'm really, really wondering is there any legal way that we can stop him from doing this? He's going to be in office for over a year, and a lot of damage can be done.
Yes, I agree. The House and Senate have tremendous power. The question is, are they willing to use it? And I am not hearing that they're willing to use it. I mean, I'm getting this from individual members of Congress. So yeah, we're going to do this and that and the other thing. But I think by and large, most of the members of the House and Senate are afraid of taking on Bush. I mean, these guys have played the Corleone family so well. They actually have intimidated members of Congress. People are afraid of being, you know, for example, voting to defund the Iraq thing. No, I don't want to be seen as being against the troops, you know, heaven forbid. And so what we have to do, I wrote a piece about this on Common Dreams. You go over to commondreams.org. It's right there. You can read it, called, you know, Join the Parade to Help Save America or something like that. And it's that we have to be the parade. We have to get out there. We have to give our elected representatives the spine to use the power that they have, because there is power in the House and Senate to stop the President of the United States from doing these kinds of things. But they are so far not showing any evidence that they're willing to use that power. And that's why, and Mary, thank you very much for the call and for bringing this up. That's why I think it's so important that we be calling Congress toll-free, 866-220-0044. Call Congress toll-free and ask for your member of the House of Representatives. If you don't know who it is, just give them your zip code. They'll tell you who it is. And ask for your two senators from your state. Make three phone calls and say, stop Bush. Stop what he's doing. He's seizing all this power. It's time to investigate the crimes that he's committed. It's time. In fact, it's even time to go back and look at the elections. I mean, but at the very least, right now, stop him in his tracks, and certainly let's not let him get us into a war with Iran. Brian in Ohio. Hey, Brian.
Hey, how you doing today?
Great. I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
You know, just like the last caller, you know, with Bush basically seizing control of all these items that, you know, have been there to help the American middle class, low class, high class, what have you not, you know, he's taken over this power that is, you know, more or less created by Congress. Now, you know, looking at all the executive decisions that he's made, what he's doing, you know, it's abuse of power. You know, and
it goes way beyond that. I mean, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act says that any federal official that violates that act by wiretapping Americans without getting a court order within 3 days of the event can go to jail for 2 years. And Bush has not only broken that law, he's bragged about breaking that law.
Right. And, you know, if you think back, you know, with President Clinton, you know, they brought him up on impeachment because he abused power and, you know, the whole thing.
Well, what, no, it wasn't because he abused power. It's because he lied before a grand jury and they said he's setting a bad example for Americans. And we don't, you know, it's all, this is a moral crisis. We can't have this kind of, Bill Clinton, yes, Bill Clinton did something that was probably worthy of disbarment as an attorney. And in fact, that's what happened. He lost his license as an attorney. He did something that was probably worthy of censure in the Congress. And I believe that there was a successful censure motion. Impeachment? No, come on. He did not subvert the Constitution of the United States the way Bush is. Good point, though, and thank you for the call. Bob in Tennessee. Hey, Bob.
We might consider, Tom, how this proto-fascism might morph into full-blown fascism. When General Petraeus was testifying before Congress, he indicated that part of this surge was going to be another 10,000 mercenaries. We've got 100,000 mercenaries over there now,
maybe,
working for the corporate army.
Right. We don't actually know the number, Bob. It might be 50,000. It might be 150,000. We don't know.
And these generals that are doing tours over there and then retiring or being forced out are going to work for Blackwater Company and other places, and they have been schooled in urban pacification, in suppression, urban warfare, and I fear for our country and for dissent in our country.
I do too. Look at who was patrolling the streets of New Orleans after the Katrina disaster. And this is not specifically to say that Blackwater is some sort of fascist tool or whatever. It's like, you know, a scalpel can cut or it can heal. Blackwater's just another company. But if politicians are bringing private corporations in and giving them police power and military powers in order to get around the Posse Comitatus law, or for that matter, if Bush is saying the Posse Comitatus law passed back in the 1870s, it says that the U.S. military cannot be used against the U.S. people. If that's what's going on, then Bob, you're spot on right. I agree with you, and I am concerned about the rise of fascism in the United States. Very concerned. Bob and Bill in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Tom. Well, there was some really bad news in the paper this morning that you've already gone over about Bush's continual increasing the stranglehold on government, and also good news that you're going to be broadcast more widely through Air America starting in about a couple weeks, which I think is good news for everybody.
Yeah, that's nice. I'm looking forward to it. It'll be fun. And thanks to Al Franken for helping make that happen. He's a good guy.
Well, I think your show is really great, and you know, and it's, I find it extremely useful, and thank God there's something now to counterbalance the hatred from right wing radio. I have a bad habit of not only listening to your show in Air America, but also I do listen to right wing radio.
Sometimes
I
love it's useful to know what the other side is up to.
You say his real name. It's not Michael Savage. It's Michael Weiner or Weiner. One of those?
I believe it's Weiner. It's one or the other. It's Weiner.
One of those is a good name.
It could be pronounced either way.
Better than Savage. It's really shocking some of the things he has said. It's discouraging that I guess 15 million people listen to him. He's advocated dragging Jimmy Carter down to Gitmo in chains.
Yeah.
Taking out the Democratic leadership and lining them up against the wall and shooting them.
I know. It's, you know, Bill, I know the whole list. And thank you for the call, by the way, and thank you for your kind words. I'm not so concerned about a talk show host grandstanding and trying to get some more PR to try and crank his ratings up among the paranoid and the dispossessed in this country. I'm more concerned, frankly, about the effect, the corrosive effect it has on democracy in America. 45 minutes past the hour.
Was in another lifetime, one of toil and blood, when blackness was a virtue, when the road was full of mud. I come in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Listener-supported radio. Our program supported by you, our listeners. Listening very carefully for our local sponsors and saying, you know, yeah, I'll support that local sponsor, you know, to whatever it may be, or our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com, all fair trade, all organic, Small Dog Electronics, get the latest iPod, smalldog.com, the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-Eco Wine, and Purina One Natural Blends at 866-380-MEOW. 866-380-MEOW. Let's see here. Bill in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. You know what? I was thinking about that bit you did. I shouldn't say bit, but that comparison a couple of years ago you did about Hitler and Bush.
Yeah, it's up at the top of my website right now, by the way.
I know.
I did a video of it.
But, I mean, there are probably some people that are too young to even probably were in school at the time. I don't know, maybe kind of a suggestion, I guess, to rerun it or something like that.
Yeah, it's worth rereading, and one of these days in the next few weeks I'll do it. And like I said, there is a video of it. It's a 28-minute video, and
yeah,
there's a link to it right off the top of my website if you want to forward it to anybody. But, Bill, you're spot on. There are some absolutely spooky, spooky parallels. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. And thanks for listening to WPTT in Pennsylvania there. Ransom in Tennessee. Hey, Ransom, what's up?
Hey, good show. In fact, I like to refer to you as the professor.
Well, thank
because
you.
Because of your knowledge and background in social studies, the U.S. Constitution. Here's the thing that's been bothering me. Ever since I started following politics in the 80s, I've seen one documented, exposed lie, corruption, breaking of the law, violation of the law, the Constitution, swindle out of the Republican Party. The question I have is, why do they still, how is it that they're still getting elected?
Well, it's not just elected. The question in my mind is, why has not some good federal prosecutor, you know, why didn't Elliot Spitzer, for example, bring up the Republican Party on RICO charges? You know, the organized crime laws. I mean, there are clear elements of criminal conspiracy in that organization.
The thing is that they don't care about the American public health, the military, world standing. They're actually hurting America, and they have been doing so for years. And I can't understand why anybody would still vote for a Republican who does this. Is it because the American public is so ignorant? Is it because they are religious fundamentalists who don't care about anything but their religious views? Are the American people so greedy that they keep electing these people? Are they dumb that they don't know what's going on?
I don't think it's that the public is so dumb, Ransom. Although P.T. Barnum said, you know, there's a sucker born every minute and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, still, I have a lot of faith in the integrity and the intelligence of the American people. I think what you're looking at is, number one, a 26-year war against the middle class that has caused Americans to go from knowing that they have job security, knowing that they have health security, knowing that they have a union behind them, knowing that they have the ability to get a good education for their kids, put their kids through school, having the baseline security that gives them, and Ransom, I got to drop the call just because your road noise is behind there, but you'll be able to hear me, that gives them the sense of security out of which they can go out on the streets and protest, or they can speak out. The 26-year war against the middle class is succeeding in some regard for the conservatives, number one. Number two, what you said is true, I think, to a large extent, but it's also, and the bad news, the good news is Republicans aren't getting reelected. In the last election, it was all Democrats who got elected. I mean, you know, some Republicans got reelected, but the Democrats right across the board. I mean, I'm an independent, but the Democrats took the House and the Senate. And I think if there was an election today for the White House, the Democrats would take that too. I think that what we have seen is the destruction of the modern Republican Party by these right-wing extremists. And then you ask about the fundamentalists. Yes, they've been using wedge strategies. And yes, as Chris Hedges talked about in this program a week or two ago, there is the Christianists, I refer to them as the Christianists, not as Christians. I consider myself a Christian. Christians are the folks who follow the teachings of Christ and who have some sense of the great awe and mystery of the universe. The Christianists are the ones who want to use a religion to run a government. And that's a really, really dangerous and destructive thing. And I think that unholy alliance within the Republican Party is what's brought it about. Steve in Kent, Washington. Hey, Steve.
Hi, how you doing, Tom? I wanted to make the argument that Bush and Cheney's invasion of Iraq has been a huge success for the main three groups that are the real constituents, you know, the folks that bought the last two elections for them. The first is the defense industry. In 1999, the defense budget was $270 billion.
And now it's over 500. Yeah, and you know who the principal lobbyist for the defense contractors was before the 2000 elections?
Go ahead.
Don Rumsfeld. That was his job.
Now, here's another one for you. Who else has benefited from this war in Iraq? The oil companies.
Sure.
1999, the average price for a barrel of crude for the whole year was $16.55. 2006, $58.30.
Yeah, ExxonMobil stock has more than doubled. Halliburton stock has more than quadrupled, as I recall.
Yeah, so they destabilized the Middle East and drove the price of oil up.
Yep.
Okay, and then the final one is the private contractors, just who you're mentioning, Halliburton and all these other guys. So
yep.
This has been hugely successful for them.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. And that's all the more reason to look into it. I mean, this is Teapot Dome all over again. The Teapot Dome when, in the Harding administration, Albert Fell, the Secretary of Interior, gave the gas rights, as I recall it was, in Wyoming to a good buddy of his for a couple $100,000. This isn't a couple $100,000. I mean, that almost brought down an administration. A Republican one, by the way. This isn't a couple $100,000. This is billions. This is hundreds of billions of dollars. And all the lives lost on top of it. Anyhow, we'll be back right after the news with a conservative debate, as it were. 57 minutes past.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Dan Gaynor is with us. He's the director of Media and Business Institute. Businessandmedia.org is the website. Dan Gaynor, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's a pleasure to be back. How are you doing today, Tom?
Good, good. Just fine. Always great talking with you, Dan. First of all, you call it the Media and Business Institute.
Yeah, it's Business and Media. Business and Media Institute.
Oh, okay, good. I was just going to say, you might want to think about, All right, so we got it wrong and you got it right. Good.
That's okay. It's think BMI, just like the Body Mass Index.
There you go. Okay. And businessandmedia.org, the website. You guys are out there running around saying that the economy is just wonderful, things are just great, this is exactly how it should be. In fact, it's even better than that. And, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but...
Yeah, that's a little bit of hyperbole there. I mean, the economy is good. It's strong. Last year, in the midst of, essentially a good economy with you've got low unemployment and lots of job growth, you have the media, on average, almost every week, either talking about recession or depression on the network news. And a couple cases, they even use video clips. And, I mean, even you have to acknowledge there's no comparison to what went on in the Great Depression to what's going on today. But they use video clips comparing how things are today with the Great Depression.
Actually, I would say, Dan, that there are some very, very similar, there are some very real parallels between the Great Depression and what's going on today. Both are the consequences of severe conservative economic policies that wipe out the middle class and cause wealth to be aggregated. We have now the top 1% in America has more wealth than the bottom 90%. The business cycle that just finished, from March 2001 has had the lowest rate of growth, annualized at 0.5% per month, lowest rate of growth since the Great Depression, of all the business cycles since that time. I mean, we're averaging, job growth is average and annualized 0.8%, 85,000 jobs a month. Our replacement rate's 150,000 jobs a month.
But since the Bush recovery 2003 in August, we've had more than 7 million jobs. And so
almost entirely driven by the war.
No, not entirely driven by the war. You look at the breakdown of the categories that those jobs are in. That's not all war-driven.
Dan, if you dump $1 trillion, or so far it's been about $360 billion actually spent. You dump $360 billion into the domestic economy. I don't care where you dump it. You know, you could dump it into building nuclear power plants, or you could dump it into building bombers. It doesn't matter. It's going to have a stimulative effect throughout the economy. And that's a massive amount of money for us to have borrowed from our children and our grandchildren. And yes, of course, you're going to see some stimulation from that. Tragically, though, because, you know, guys on your side of the aisle there have worked so aggressively to weaken our labor laws, you've got people working 2 and 3 and 4 jobs being counted as, you know, 2 and 3 and 4 new jobs created. You've got jobs that don't have the benefits that jobs used to have. You've got jobs that don't have the security that jobs used to have. You've got jobs that don't have, frankly, the pay that jobs used to have.
Jobs don't have the security that jobs have because the world has changed. We live in a much more global economy, and just whether we like it or not, that's just a fact. We have much more technology that enables people to have the freedom to, in many cases, work from their home, work, you know, freelance, or work from a home for a job that might be 2,000, 3,000 miles away. That gives people a lot more opportunity. If you know, look at just how the Depression, the average unemployment rate was something close to 20%, and that was in a time period where people had their blinders on. They didn't really count women. They didn't count minorities. And now, nationally, our average unemployment is 4.5%.
There's and nobody's buying no that number, Dan. Nobody's buying that number.
No matter what number you come up with, literally, no matter what. I spent a fair amount of time on left-wing websites. No matter the most outlandish number I have ever seen claimed is so far below that number. And then
my point, I'm not disagreeing with you that we're not in a depression. I'll give you that. We're not in anything like the Republican Great Depression. We may well be soon. I mean, here we have Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush. Between the two of them, have run up the majority of an $8 trillion deficit. I mean, it's a mind-numbing amount of money that's going to have to be paid. And you know, Bush this year now he's coming in with a deficit. That's our total debt. Excuse me. This year he's coming in now with a deficit that he says is $150 billion more or less. But in fact, when you include the appropriations for the war, which are off budget, and when you include the money that he's borrowing from Social Security, about $250 billion, it's close to $500 billion. I mean, this is mind-boggling, awful stuff economically. But we're not where we were during the Republican Great Depression, but we're awful close. The Americans for example, the share of wages and salaries out of national income in 2006 fell to 51.5%. That's the smallest share since we first started collecting this information in the 1940s. Incomes of the typical household are still lower right now than they were in 2000. By $1,300 in inflation-adjusted dollars, if you want to actually look at the real number.
But
wages are falling.
The elephant in the room, which unfortunately is the worst terror attack America has ever received, and then...
Oh, come on, Dan. 3,000 people died, and how many companies went out of business? The number of companies that went out of business...
That caused the economy. Look at how much of the money... I am not about to defend some of the crazy spending that goes on in Washington, whether it's Republican or Democrat. I'm not about to.
But you can't tell me that 9/11 is the reason why that we've done away with tariffs and we're in this, what you say is simply a fact, this global economy, most of the other countries around the world are saying, no, thank you very much, we'll keep our tariffs in place.
I love it when the left talks about tariffs on one hand and fair trade, not free trade, fair trade on the other, where we're supposed to take tariffs down to help third world nations.
Yeah, I'm not an advocate of what's called fair trade, frankly.
I mean, we have a rare situation here where we've actually been recovering for now 3 years. We've been on a good recovery track after 9/11, after the recession was caused by 9/11, even though only it's a horrendous thing to say, only 3,000 people died in that event. I knew two of the people who died in that event. It was a horrible thing, and
it has nothing to do with our economy, Dan.
No,
we're looking at the lowest rate of growth we've seen since the Great Depression, and the reason why is very, very simple. George Bush came into office, and he had this wacky idea that if he gave $550,000 to a bunch of millionaires, that they would create one job. For every $550,000 he would give away, one job would be created. Here's George Bush in his own words promoting this idea.
With a robust package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
Now, you do the math. That's $550,000 per job. That's absolutely insane. And yet that's what he ran on, and that's what you're claiming the benefit for? Well, yeah, we borrowed all that money, and we've created a few jobs. I don't think that that's a good thing for the United States of America.
We've created more than a few jobs. 7 million is a lot more than a few, and I'm sure the people who have some...
You've created 7 million. How many have you lost during that period of time?
Since August 2003, that's a net gain of 7 million jobs.
No, since Bush came into office.
That's a bogus claim because you're ignoring, like I said...
So you just want to look at the last 2 years.
What was that?
You just want to look at the last 2.5 years.
No, I want to look at since recovery, because that's what we're talking about here. We've been in a recovery since August 2003.
Okay, so by here, you call this a recovery. By the third quarter of 2006, the amount of household debt outstanding relative to disposable income, in other words, the amount of money that people owe relative to their income, is 130.9%. In other words, they owe 130% more than they earn. What is wrong with that picture?
What's wrong? Well, the part that you're leaving out of that picture is, of course, home values, which went up massively during that time period. And a lot of people, spent money that was part of their net value of their home.
So it's just fine that people have lousy paying jobs. They can take equity out of their homes.
They don't
and end up with nothing and end up with nothing to retire on.
Again, they don't have lousy paying jobs. And of course, as happens in every recovery, the first initially businesses recover, then they start hiring, and then you get the job market tighter, and then salaries go up, which of course salaries and benefits have been going up and went up a fair amount in 2006.
Right now, what we're seeing, pre-tax corporate profits relative to national income amounted to 14.1% of the third quarter in 2006, the largest share since 1950. In other words, corporations are doing just great. After-tax profits as a share of national income, 9.9%, the highest since 1947. Net investment, however, this is companies saying, okay, we're going to take all that money, we're going to put it into the United States. Only 1.8% of GDP in September 2006 for the year ending. That's the lowest it's been since the Great Depression.
Who do you think owns those companies? More than 50% of the Americans are invested in some way, form, or fashion in the stock market. So Americans are getting the benefit.
I would say a lot of those companies are actually owned by Germans and Japanese and Saudis and Chinese. Dan Gator, always great talking with you. I appreciate your coming on and mixing it up with us.
It is always a pleasure, but you owe me a copy of your book.
Okay, all righty. Dan Gator, he's the director of media of the Business and Media Institute, businessandmedia.org. 16 minutes past the hour.
And I'm taking my country back. Boys, you ain't been doing it right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you botched Iraq. So I'm taking my country back.
Yes, indeed, my friends. Time to take our country back. Get out there and be part of the parade. Right, we have to be the ones to whom our politicians are paying attention. We have to be the ones who are saying, this is the kind of America that we want to live in. We want to live in the kind of America that our founders envisioned. We want to live in the children of the Enlightenment. The liberal, as George Washington said, I hope to ever see America at the forefront of liberality. That awful liberal, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, John Jay, James Mason, John Mason, George Mason, excuse me. On the list goes, right? Harry Truman, by the way, speaking of recessions and depressions, our quote for the day, Harry Truman, it's a recession when your neighbor loses his job. It's a depression when you lose yours. Yeah. Well, the reason why we have folks like Dan Gaynor on the program on a regular basis is not only to help you learn how to win the water cooler wars, or at least participate in them. So many people, I get emails from folks and people drop in the chat room, which you can get to by going to tomhartman.com, by the way, and just click live chat. It's free. Just drop in and say hi. You won't get any spam or anything else like that. But you can hang out with some of the finest minds in the world. People say, people like this in my family, in my family, they talk like this. We get together for Thanksgiving and I just don't know what to say or I'm at work and somebody says, things are just great. And I try to model for you how to win the water cooler wars or how to engage in them. I don't always win. You know, it's not, I don't play the games that guys like Bill O'Reilly, cut his mic, shut him up. I don't find much value in that. But I do think that it is important that we be able to engage in reasonable discussions where there's not blood on the floor at the end of the day, and we get our point of view out. And the point of view that, frankly, I'm most concerned about is this libertarian, objectivist, conservative worldview, economically speaking. The libertarians I refer to as Republicans who like to smoke pot and want to get laid, you know, they're all in favor of being liberal socially, but economically, no. They're all in favor of leave it up to the corporations. Government has no role in anything. I'm sorry, that's wrong. There is this thing called the commons, society, collectively. We do things collectively together. This is the Michael Wiener clip that I was playing earlier, you know, where he's going, I earned everything I've got. You try and take it away from me. I'm sorry. None of us earned everything we got. None of us. Yes, a lot of us have worked really hard. In fact, I'd say most Americans right across the board have worked really hard. Some of us have been luckier than others. Some of us have been more successful than others. But none of us got there alone. All of us got there. You know, we all, what's the old phrase, stand on the shoulders of giants. I mean, we all stand on the shoulders of all those who went before us. And we stand on the shoulders of our society collectively. We are the beneficiaries of a liberal public education system, of the liberal notion that we should have water purification systems so we don't have cholera epidemics, of the liberal notion that we should have public health services so that we can stop. I mean, this is the major thing that has led to the extension of lifespan in the United States is public health. Basic sanitation, purifying, for example, waste material. Knowing that, and we're not 100% there, obviously, yet, but, you know, knowing at least that our streams and rivers are not, you know, cholera infested. I remember reading a letter by Edgar Allan Poe. He lived in New York City, and he fled New York City and went up to upstate New York because the cholera epidemic was so bad in New York City. So many people he knew were dying of cholera. They were getting it from the drinking water. They didn't know at the time. People thought it was the bad air. We are all, you know, our public highway system, our public rights of way for our communication system, for our telephone lines, our public airwaves. We are, none of us made it alone. Our banking system that allows us to actually have money and know that it's going to be safe. You know, to the extent that the wonders of the Fed don't get me started, but nonetheless, it's there, and we do have a stable currency. Our court system, our legislature, we've established the rules of the game. These are all ideas of the liberals who created this country, that government can do good. Now, there are a lot of things you don't want government doing. I don't want government making my TV, my computer, my shoes. I don't want them involved in those things at all. Although I would like them to say, you know, if you're going to try and make these things overseas where the labor's cheaper, we're going to charge an import tax when you bring it in so that we still have jobs here. I'm all in favor of that. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 440-8466, 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman radio program. So glad to be with you and to have you back with us. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. Joe in Brookings, Oregon. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program.
Yes, I've called you before about the Aaron Russo movie, and I'm going to be showing that at the Brookings Library at 5 p.m. today. If people want to watch that, admission is free. In Brookings, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be showing the Aaron Russo movie. But on the non-binding resolutions, this is a ridiculous thing that the Democrats and Chuck Hagel came up with in the first place, although I believe Chuck Hagel is a little bit more sincere than the Democrats on this. It's ridiculous. We're to be talking about symbolic votes when you got people dying over in Iraq. There's nothing symbolic about.
Those bullets are not symbolic. Yeah, we're going to say the same thing. You're right. You're absolutely right, Joe. And that's why people need to be contacting their member of Congress.
Well, yeah, you know, it's ridiculous. You got the Republicans first. They threatened to filibuster a non-binding resolution.
Yeah.
This is ridiculous. I
spot on. Absolutely agree with you, Joe. Very well said. And so please contact your member of Congress and say enough already. Those are real bullets. We don't need they are not non-binding bullets. Let's do something about this. John in San Francisco, California. Hey, John.
Hi. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. You're live and on the air.
Oh, sorry. I didn't realize that. You know, my comment, I was reading the book, Failed States by Noam Chomsky, and he quoted Robert Jackson, the American justice at Nuremberg, as in that judicial proceeding enacted a principle of universality, that it enacted a standard that everybody would be held to. But unfortunately, it was only applied retroactively because, you know, it is evidence of moral bankruptcy that we never prosecuted any of our personnel for the atrocities that were committed against Germany in terms of atrocities against civilians. And
tends to be what happens when you have winners and losers in war, is that but on the one hand. On the other hand, though, I would submit to you, John, that and thank you for calling and raising the point, that and Chomsky and Zinn occasionally for me are both of them I have tremendous respect for and have both been on this program, and Howard and Zinn and I have spoken in the same venues, occasionally focus, in my opinion, to the detriment, frankly, at a certain level of enthusiastic, forward-looking participation on the part of the American people to the warts and sins of America's past. They're certainly there, and I'm not putting them down. But, you know, count two. This, you know, from the Nuremberg trials, right? War is essentially an evil thing. This count two of the indictment charges the defendants with committing specific crimes against peace by planning, preparing, initiating, and waging wars of aggression against a number of other states. It will be convenient to consider the question. This is from the arguments, the prosecutor's arguments. It will be convenient to consider the question of the existence of a common plan and the question of aggressive war together, and to deal later in this judgment with the question of the individual responsibility of the defendants. The charges in the indictment that the defendants planned and waged aggressive wars are charges of the utmost gravity. War is essentially an evil thing. Its consequences are not confined to the belligerent state alone, but affect the whole world. To initiate a war of aggression, therefore, is not only an international crime, it is the supreme international crime, differing only from other war crimes in that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole. So, there you go. Steve in Albany, New York. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to call in and say that I thought it was especially pointed today that the issues you're talking about, since it's FDR's birthday.
It is, and FDR said,
I see one-third of a nation ill-housed, ill-clad, ill-nourished.
And he did something about it.
Exactly, and my local public radio station was broadcasting from Hyde Park this morning, and they weren't taking calls, and I was hoping maybe you could answer my question, because you play the Teddy Roosevelt clip frequently, too,
mm-hmm.
about the living wage.
Sure.
How did they end up in different parties? Well, one was in the Republican Party, one was in the Democratic
Party.
Well,
first of all, they were not, I mean, they didn't, I'm not sure that they even knew each other. You know, they were very, very distant cousins. And
no, actually, today they were talking about it on my public radio station that as a boy he was greatly influenced by, you know, his cousin Teddy.
Right. Influenced by him, but in person or simply by what Teddy did in the public realm?
No, in person.
Interesting. Okay.
There was definitely some interaction there, and that's kind of what led him into going into politics.
Yeah.
So,
well, I don't pretend to be a Roosevelt scholar in terms of his personal life or his biographies and things. I just am familiar with his policies. So how they ended up in the two different parties, I don't know. You know, what's interesting is that the Republican Party was a reform party. In 1856 in Jackson, Michigan, when the Republican Party was started, it was started in reaction, in part because the Federalists had imploded in the 1820s, and then the Whigs came along, and then they imploded in the 1850s. And so there was, you know, kind of somebody at a certain level, they wanted to reinvent the Federalist Party. But to a large extent, the Democratic Party, which was originally the Democratic Republican Party, and in the 1820s dropped the Republican name, but the party that Thomas Jefferson started as a progressive, forward-looking, very liberal party, had become the party of establishment, of corruption, and of slavery. And so it had become what the Federalists had started out as in a way, except the Federalists were anti-slavery, but it had become, you know, the party of the elite power brokers. And so in response to that, the Republican Party was created as a reform party. And from 1856 until the 1870s, or really the mid-1880s, the Republican Party viewed itself as the party of reform, the party that pushed back against corporate power. There's an op-ed piece that I wrote. If you go to tomhartmann.com and click Articles on Democracy, it's called Republicans, Please Take Your Party Back. You'll have to scroll down the page a ways because it was about 3 years ago that I wrote it. But it's on that page. It was published first in Common Dreams, in which I found a copy of an 1886 published book. In fact, my old friend Rob Call and I were in a used bookstore in Pennsylvania, and we found these things. The history of the Republican Party, the history of the Democratic Party. And it had the Republican Party's, as I recall, 1882 platform. And the platform called for things like woman suffrage, minimum wage, the end of corruption in government, end of patronage systems, public funding of elections. I mean, the Republican Party was very progressive at that point in time. And over the next 15 years, through the 1880s and into the early 1890s, the Republican Party became captive of, as the Democratic Party was at that time too, in large part, captive of the robber barons, the large corporate interests. And, you know, the Samuel Huntingtons and the whole bunch of them. And the consequence of that was that the robber barons rose and people started trying to create third parties, the progressives. You know, the union movement, of course, was doing its own thing. But there was the progressive movement. There was the populist movement. There was the progressive farmers movement, the Grange movement. All of these came about in the 1880s, 1890s, and early 1900s. And Teddy Roosevelt, I think, you know, saw when McKinley died, Teddy Roosevelt saw which way the wind was blowing and said, okay, you know, that's the way I'm going to go. And he changed his politics to go along with the earlier perspective of the Republican Party. You know, how he got to that, I you know, not enough of a scholar of Teddy Roosevelt to tell you.
Right.
But it's...
Oh, that's
it's
very good.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, I missed you in Washington, D.C., too, but I even lost the people I went with, so...
Yeah, it was a mess. There was a lot of people there. There was a lot of people there. It was a great march, and the high point for me was the church service in the morning at that Lutheran church. So, anyhow, Steve, thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you, and I do appreciate it. Eric in New York City. Eric, is this a quickie? I've only got about 10 seconds here before we get.
I better hold till the. It's a long answer.
It's a long answer. All righty. I'm just going to put you on hold.
I'm
just informed by Alex that I have a minute. I thought I was right there. Eric, go ahead.
Well, basically, I wanted you to relate an anecdote about yourself and your father from when you were a child and how it relates to the conservative mind, their whole worldview. And it's a long answer because I do have a couple of questions, so I do want to wait for the break.
Okay,
so,
well, I'll just, you know, What's the question?
Well, basically, when you were a kid, someone in your class had something stolen from you, from him, and he accused you of it.
Yeah, when
and
I was
you
in
asked
second
your dad
grade.
About it, and he said, "Keep away from that kid because he steals."
Right.
And hey, it relates to the conservative worldview because you always talking about how they see people as no damn good, basically, and. It's Psych 101, basically, because they see themselves as they see the world as how they are.
Yeah,
they
which is human characteristic.
Good.
Yeah, an absolutely human characteristic. We all see everybody else through our own lens.
Exactly.
Yeah. Good point, Eric. Thank you very much. And yeah, that did happen when I was a little kid. I was second grade. I was so bummed out because this kid accused me of it in front of the class and of stealing his pencils, and I hadn't. And Dad said, "Yeah, he's." He's somebody who's obsessed with stealing. He was right, turned out. Anyhow, 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls right after this. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where reason is our lifestyle choice. Welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of Saturday. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the air with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
What's up in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, the president's out of town, so while he's away, the mice will play, and the mice were playing definitely today in the form of various committees. This morning it was the Senate Judiciary Committee, which was chaired by Senator Feingold, who's not actually the chair. The chair is Patrick Leahy, but he allowed Feingold to chair because it was Feingold's pet topic, which is whether the Congress holds the power of the purse to cut off funds. And he intends to introduce legislation tomorrow saying that, not only does it, but we're going to.
Pat Leahy handed that over to Russ Feingold. I'm impressed. Pat Leahy,
yes.
Pat Leahy is a very I've met Pat Leahy. I can't say that I know him, you know, well or anything like that. But I've met him. I've talked with him. The guy, he was my senator for 10 years. The guy is a former federal prosecutor. He's as cautious and thoughtful and deliberate as any person I've ever met in my life. And
yeah.
and if he took that extraordinary symbolic action of giving to Russ Feingold the opportunity to be chair sit-in chair or whatever of the Judiciary Committee, so that Feingold could advance that agenda. That's a huge endorsement of that agenda.
It really was. And sitting right next to Feingold was Senator Specter, who, while moderate and modulated, nevertheless made the point that even though the president says he's the decider, Specter suggested politely that there was more than one decider in this country.
Yeah, I thought that was a great quote from Arlen Specter. He said, quote, "The decider is a shared and joint responsibility." I would suggest respectfully to the president that he is not the sole decider.
It was a very, very interesting hearing, and it was really more of a sounding board for the senators. But they had five very distinguished law professors who didn't all agree. You know, one of them thought that the president had extraordinary power to wage war, and the others didn't quite feel that way. But certainly Feingold made it clear that he will introduce his legislation tomorrow. So that was this morning's excitement. This afternoon's excitement is twofold. At 3 o'clock, there's a press conference with Speaker Pelosi, Jack Murtha, and the others who went with her to Iraq and Afghanistan, and she'll be talking about her experiences over there. And I think that's going to be very interesting to see what she has to say about what she found out while she was over there.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say we also have the Senate Foreign Relations Committee doing a hearing on ways forward in Iraq with Baker and Hamilton.
Okay. Fascinating. Fascinating. While the Senate is talking about cutting off funds to Iraq, is anybody? I know Dennis Kucinich has put something forward like that in the House, but I haven't. My sense of it is that it hasn't gotten any traction. That in the Senate, it's actually being taken seriously. Am I correct in my analysis of that, or am I missing something?
No, I think you're correct in your analysis of that. I'm never as secure in my knowledge of what's going on the House side as I am on the Senate side. I'm pretty sure you're right on that.
Yeah. So we really need to be applying some pressure to the House. People need to be calling their representatives, their members.
Well, if they feel that way, yeah, particularly since this is the first Congress that the House actually does have the upper hand. The Democrats have the upper hand in the House.
Yeah, and all spending bills are supposed to originate in the House, are they not?
I believe so.
I mean, that's my recollection in the Constitution. It starts in the House, it gets approved by the Senate, and then it gets sent to the President, and then he has the ability to spend the money. But interesting. Okay, great. Well, Victoria Jones, thank you very much. Any other news you wanted to share with us real quick?
I believe that Judith Miller of the New York Times is supposed to be testifying in the Libby trial today. So that'll be interesting, seeing if she went to jail for like 3 months so that she could avoid testifying, but it didn't do her much good in the end, did it?
Interesting. Well, and maybe now she has something that she wants to say. I mean, you know, you just never know. So, okay. Thank you very much, Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Good talking.
Thank you.
Bye now. Don in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Don, welcome to the program. What's up?
Taking off the speaker. I was listening to the speaker and reading the paper at the same time. A couple of things. I had just turned your program on when I heard you talking about tariffs.
Yes, sir.
And I'm a recovering Republican. I've been a Democrat since 2000.
Mm-hmm.
So I run a small business, Shutters and Blind Company,
mm-hmm.
and I buy my shutters from China. And the reason mm-hmm. I buy my shutters from China is not because they're cheaper, because they're not. I can buy a cheaper shutter that's made here in Phoenix. But it's mm-hmm. a better made product and it's delivered on time. It seems like my local manufacturers can't do anything right except shoot themselves in the foot time and time again.
Well, it's a shame. They shouldn't be in business.
What's that?
Then they shouldn't stay in business. I mean, that's, you know, kind of business 101. You make a lousy product, you go out of business.
Well, the way they stay in business is if they sell to another retailer like me, they put us to the back of the boat and do their own retail stuff first. So my thing is, I don't believe I should be punished because I'm trying to get my customers their stuff on time and a better made product.
Yeah, and I understand that, but there's a larger issue here, John, and that, Don, and that is whether or not we want to have industries in the United States. I mean, entire industries have been extracted from this nation. The tool and die industry is almost dead in this country. The textile industry is almost dead in this country. The steel industry in this country is on the ropes. You've got entire industries that have moved overseas. We can't make a missile right now without chips that we have to buy from China, a country that has threatened us militarily.
I understand, and what I'm saying is we can't do it blanket. We have to look at it item by item.
I agree.
Because I understand.
That's how you do tariffs, by the way. I mean, there's right now we have tens of thousands of tariffs. If you look at the U.S. code, you can track them down. There's actually a website for them. And you know, most of them are fairly small, 1-2%, stuff like that. They're fairly low. There are some that are fairly high. But you do it on an item-by-item basis. You're absolutely right. Don, I got to run. Thanks for the call, though, and raising the issue. One of these days we'll take the whole issue of tariffs and turn it into an entire segment and really get into it, because it is a topic that requires some careful thought and good analysis, plus some history. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
So does it take a community to raise a kid? Does it take a family? Does it take a village, to paraphrase Hillary Clinton? Or does it just take a mother and a father? Or two moms, or two dads, or one parent? Or what should be the essence of the family structure that raises a child or children? Welcome back to the program, by the way. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Stephen Gabriel is the author of To Be a Father, published by Spence Publishing, website spencepublishing.com, and available in bookstores, of course, all around the country. And first of all, Stephen, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Let me identify what I believe from the news release we got from you, you are concerned about, and you correct me. Please feel free at any point if I have this wrong. In Canada, before they legalized gay marriage, there was a lesbian couple who had been together since 1990 and in a stable relationship, two women. One was a university professor, the other was an attorney, and they decided to have a baby. And rather than going to a sperm bank and just getting some, you know, anonymous sperm, they had a friend who was a man, and they thought he was kind of a cool guy, and they said, why don't you be the sperm donor? And so he donated sperm, and they did artificial insemination on one of the women, and a baby was produced. And they figured, because they knew this guy, that the kid should have twice-a-week contact with the child. And so this was about 6 years ago, 7 years ago, and the child grew up having basically two moms that he lived with, and also his dad, who came over twice a week and hung out with him. And then the moms were able to get married, because Canada legalized gay marriage, and one of the other mothers could have adopted the child. And so now you've got a child who's got two parents, two mothers. But what that did was that legally disqualified the father, the biological father, from ever having any rights. And these two women felt that that father should have some rights, because what if both of them got killed in a car accident or something? They would want him to be able to claim the child and raise the child. And so they went to the court and they said, this child should be able to legally have three parents. And the court said, yes. And you think that's wrong. Now, have I got all that right?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, why do you think that's wrong?
Well, I think that, number one, it's morally wrong. I think that that it's an inherently unstable sort of relationship, and you know, I think we just have to go back to the way that it's always been, and look at the fact that we are created by a man and a woman, and the based on the complementarity of man and woman. And what the man and the woman, the mother and the father, bring to the family, which can be quite different. And this is what children need. They need a stable, nurturing, loving relationship from a mother and a father. And a child is not going to have the kind of model that that he.
So it sounds like what you're opposing is the fact that he is that this child is the child of a lesbian couple, not that the biological father has also been given some legal right as a parent.
Well, the whole thing is a mess.
Whole thing. All right, then if you say we should go back to the way it's always been, are you suggesting that the law should be involved in this? In other words, that the legal rights that this father got in this case, this biological father got, should not have been given to him, or that the legal right of adoption by two women should not have been allowed? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, we never should have gotten to this situation.
In that case, then I would assume that you are also opposed to divorce being legal in the United States.
I think that it certainly should not be easy. That's for sure. I think we need to keep in mind.
But we're talking about forbidding things. You want to forbid gay adoption. You want to forbid gay marriage. You say, you know, having three parents is too much for a kid, and yet there are thousands, probably millions of children in the United States who have four parents, or in some cases five or six or seven parents, because one of their parents has been divorced sometimes multiple times, and so they've got a dad and they've got a stepdad, and maybe they've even got a new stepdad, and they've got a stepmom and another stepmom plus their biological mom, and who are they living with this week, and all that kind of stuff. And it seems to me that if that's really your position, then what you should be arguing for is to say that it should be absolutely illegal for anybody to ever get a divorce in the United States.
I would say that one could make the case that it is not to our country's benefit, certainly not to the children's benefit, to have legalized divorce in this country.
Okay, then let me take that one apart. Then you're suggesting then that parents should be raising kids, because parents are in your mind the ones who can, you know, a mother and a father can do the very best job of raising the child. And yet, in most, if you look back through history, in most Aboriginal and Indigenous societies, in hunting-gathering societies, in early agricultural societies, and frankly, through most of the history of what we call civilization, right up basically until about the last 150 years with the advent of the middle class. Children were typically raised by their grandparents, not their parents. Their parents were working.
There's something to be said for having an extended family that can provide the support needed to raise the children. And
I'm of the opinion, frankly, that grandparents can do a better job than parents. I know that, you know, I had kids, my wife and I, we have three children, and our first child was born when I was 22 years old. And I don't think that I was anywhere near as good a parent as I could be now as a grandparent. I mean, it's just, and I have friends, you know, I'm in my 50s now, I have friends of my age who are having children, and it seems a little old, but frankly, but nonetheless, the, you know, people in their 40s having children, and they're much better parents. They have enough experience in life. Shouldn't we just leave this to the family rather than getting all moral about it and thinking that we have some ultimate truth?
No, I think there is an ultimate truth, and I think there's a natural law, and it seems evident that the mother and the father who bring the child into the world has a responsibility to provide the children that they bring into the world with the tools, the virtues that child needs in order to be successful in life.
But that's not the way it works in all human societies, and it's certainly not the way it works in all primate or all mammal societies. In many mammalian and primate societies, the young are raised by the community, not by the parents, because the parents are the perfect age to be primarily engaged in gathering food.
Well, they're not. The children were very much involved in the gathering of that food as well. It was, you know, it was a family operation. The children were were involved in the farming and everything involved in running the household and the family. So they were very much involved. The problem comes when we have absentee parents that have no contact with the children.
I don't disagree with you there, and I think, frankly, divorce is a social evil, although I don't want to outlaw it. I remember being in Ireland, must have been 15 years ago or so, driving by a billboard, and it showed a mom and a dad and a little baby in the, or a little, you know, 10-year-old in the middle with a big tear in her eye, and the headline, a huge headline, said, "Don't let it happen." And I was like, "What's this?" And a friend of mine who was Irish said, we're voting to legalize divorce. And I was like, wait a minute, divorce is illegal in Ireland? And it was up until some, you know, 15 or 20 years ago, whenever it was that I saw that poster. But, I'm not suggesting this should be illegal. I think it's a tragedy when it happens, frankly. But nonetheless, we as a society, it seems that what you're trying to do is legislate morality, and that just doesn't very often work.
Well, you can't legislate morality. I agree with you there, but I think that we can protect the innocent, and we can recognize the importance of the family.
But you're talking about natural law, for example. I mean, penguins. When there are gay penguins who raise children. If a female penguin dies and there's an egg, two males will take responsibility for
it. But we're not.
You want to outlaw that?
But we're not penguins, are we?
No. But we're part of the animal kingdom, aren't we?
We have reason. Penguins don't have reason. Penguins act on instinct. All right.
If the instinct is for a gay couple to care for the young, isn't that a good instinct?
It's a good instinct, but it's...
Then why do you object to it?
It's a good instinct, but it is not well-founded.
It's not biblical.
Well, it's not. It goes against the natural law. I mean, if all we have to do is look at the human being... And if you deny the complementarity of the man and the woman, if you deny the fertility associated with the marriage act that occurs, then you're denying something very fundamental about who we are.
Okay. Stephen Gabriel, he's the author of a book, To Be a Father. The website, SpencePublishing.com. Stephen, thanks for coming on and talking with us today.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
16 minutes past the hour.
Hugging, love making, pro-choice and gay wedding, widespread digging hippies like me. Skin color blinded, conspiracy minded, protesters of corporate greed.
We who have nothing, and most likely will till we all end up locked up in jail by conservative Christian, right-wing Republican, straight white American man. Diamonds and dogs, boys and girls, living together in two separate worlds.
And welcome back to the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman program, 21 minutes past the hour. You know, in my mind, this boils down to two very simple concepts. The concept of civil rights, human rights, and the concept of love. That what a child needs is love. Children need love. They need a sense of safety. They need, you know, a Maslow, you know, his hierarchy of human needs, just the basic fundamental stuff which can be provided by somebody, whether or not they are biologically male or female. I just don't see why a particular set of genitals qualifies or disqualifies a person for parenting. Number one. And number two, our the continual progress in our society that we have been seeing from its founding, at least the founding of this country, of saying, oh, African Americans, all right, we'll give them rights. Or we'll acknowledge that they've had rights all along that we've been denying them, would be a better way to say it. Oh, women, yes, we'll acknowledge that they should have had they're human beings, they should have had these rights all along, and bring them into the family. And now here we are, gays and lesbians and transgendered people. And yes, they're human beings too. And they're capable of love and they're capable of parenting, in my opinion. And to condemn a family because they want to provide a loving environment for a child is, in my mind, frankly tragic. Gary in Corydon, is it Corydon, Indiana?
Yes, sir.
Hey, Gary.
Hi. I had 2 points. I was going to make three, but I decided to leave one out there.
Okay.
The first thing is that, you know, the one that I hear, this is an argument that people make all the time, I hear it regularly, is this natural law stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and as you pointed out, this with the penguins, it's not just penguins. It's all almost entirely through.
Virtually every mammal, mammalian species, and penguins aren't mammals. I mean, they're birds, but virtually all mammalian species have somewhere between 5 and 10% of their population is gay. And when population density increases, it actually goes up, at least with rats.
That's right. And also the other thing is, you know, I believe it wasn't, it may have been, I'm pretty sure it was last year, the American Pediatric Society, the American Psychiatric Association, I don't know, several all got together and released a study at every point that children that were raised by gay or lesbian parents were at or above the children in two-parent normal.
Right. Right. By any measure, whether it's using MMPI, you know, emotional competence, or whether it's using intellectual competence, school talent, by any measure, yes, absolutely.
And absolutely. These people that come on, you know, they have this opinion, and you know, I mean, it's obviously religion based. You know, it has nothing to do with facts.
Yeah, you're spot on, Gary. Well said, Pamela in Lakewood, Washington. Hey, Pamela.
Hi, how are you?
Just fine, thank you.
Well, of course, I wanted to ask Mr. Gabriel this question, but and I always get my back up when I hear people starting to talk about legislating morality. But anyway, I wonder if at the very end, when he talked about natural law, that people ought to live according to natural law, I would have liked to have asked him what he meant, because I think he was thinking about the Bible, but that's not natural law. What you were talking about is natural law, what happens in nature, and that's like you're like your last guest, and you were just discussing that's across the board in nature.
Yeah.
And he actually was totally contradicted himself when he said that we should be living by natural law. Yes, we should, but that's not what the Bible is.
Right. In nature, homosexuality is accepted and in many cases celebrated, and frankly, I think it should be in more human societies, and many human societies it is. But in the dominator, male-dominated, hierarchical societies that we call civilization, by and large, it's not. It's a tragedy.
And I think one of the points that your last caller made was really interesting too, when he was talking about, you know, the outcomes of children that are raised by homosexual couples.
Mm-hmm.
Homosexual couples don't get to have children by accident. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which heterosexual couples do constantly.
Right. Right. So in all probability, there's less child abuse.
They're very on purpose about choosing when they have a child. And so when they have a child, they really want one. And that shows how much reproductive choice is important, because when you choose that you want a child because you really want one, the outcome is better.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, as opposed to just having children haphazardly because it just happens to be a biological imperative that happens whether you're meaning it to or not. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, although I also don't think we can minimize, you know, whether it's hormonal or what, you know, minimize the reality that I think probably most all parents have experienced. I certainly did, Pamela, before I had children, feeling rather ambivalent about it, and then watching my daughter be born, and all of a sudden, you know, it's like there's a bond there that never will go away.
That happened to me too, and yet at the same time, like you, I didn't feel I was...
I've got to wrap it up, Pamela. I'm sorry. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
I ain't looking to compete with you, beat or cheat or mistreat you, simplify you, pacify you, deny, defy, or crucify you. All I really want to do is maybe be friends with you.
And welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for clean elections and fresh air and healthy forests. No, really healthy forests. Welcome back to our pro and families that you know function and care for each other. TomHartman.com, our website, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Catherine in Gig Harbor, Washington. Hey, Catherine, welcome to the program. Catherine, I'm going to put you back on hold. You need to be listening to your phone and not your radio. Ian in San Francisco, California. Hey, Ian.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Just great. What's up?
Listen, what I'm thinking is, I don't think the Bible says anything about adoption by anyone. I think it's silent on the subject of adoption. And I'm sure it doesn't say anything about how it's okay for a single-parent household to adopt children and whether that's a good idea, or it just doesn't get into it at all. So I don't see how they go to the Bible for any of this.
Well, it's, you know, Adam and Eve. But here's what's interesting. Adam and Eve sent their son, you know, after Cain killed Abel, they sent him off to find a wife. Where?
That's a good question.
Yeah, I mean, it's just at some point you go, wait a minute, off to the land of Nod, actually, is where they sent him. And it's like, that's interesting. That's an interesting one.
Ian, but I have a feeling the Bible doesn't say a word about adoption.
I frankly don't remember. I know that it's fairly liberal with divorce, and it's also, you know, you had a bunch of people. Solomon had 700 wives. You know, it wasn't until the New Testament that Paul suggested that to be a bishop in the church or high up in the church, you ideally should be a person with a single wife, but it wasn't necessary. Standards have changed multiple times over the years. Let's leave it at that. Ian, thanks for the call. Ty in Mesa, Arizona. Hey, Ty, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm listening to your animal kingdom argument. I'm wondering maybe we should go to truly animal kingdom and animal societies where one male services 100 females and they, you know, raise them as a community that way.
Well, the Mormon Church has, you know, had that as their position for some time. It's not their official position now, but there is an offshoot of the Mormon Church that is still practicing polygamy. I suspect, though, that if you look at the animal kingdom...
No, I'm not talking about Mormons. I'm talking about mammal society. That's what you're talking about, the animal kingdom.
Right, yeah. So the point is, if you look at mammals, what you find typically is that there are both monogamous animals and polygamous animals. There are some that are rigorously monogamous, and there are others that are rigorously, like the bonobo monkeys that are just, they'll have sex with anybody, anywhere, anytime, on and on it goes. I mean, they're beyond polygamous, you know, they're promiscuous. And but I suspect that human beings are biologically designed to be monogamous. I mean, I think that that's why our societies keep coming back to that. I think we're just wired that way. And I suspect, frankly, that those societies where you find polygamy tend to be the most patriarchal and tend to be the ones that are most often involved in wars. And why? Because the wars create a shortage of men. And so you have fewer men, you have more women, and thus you have to have polygamy, or you know you're not going to have you're going to have a bunch of, you know, unmarried women who are not producing children who can then go off to wars. I mean, if you take it back and look at it in that historical context. Anyhow, Catherine in Gig Harbor. Hey, Catherine.
Oh, hi, Tom. I wanted to in light of the natural law argument, draw your attention to a book called Evolution's Rainbow. Author is Ruth Garden. That's the last name. I forget her first name. She's a transgendered female, and she's an evolutionary biologist at Stanford University. It's a huge book full of examples of exactly what you're talking about in the animal kingdom.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to make was a very personal point, and that mm-hmm. is my own.
Mm-hmm.
I have three children. I'm a transgendered woman. I'm married to a woman. I have an ex-wife, and my ex-wife has a boyfriend. I have three children. My oldest son is an international tour guide. My daughter just graduated from college, is preparing to go to graduate school, and my son is about to graduate from high school. He's an honor student, already accepted to college. They're doing very well, thank you.
Yeah, so your kids have multiple parents, as it were. They have four adults in their lives. And one's gay, one's transgendered, and two are straight, right? Am I getting all that right?
And that's about as close as you can come, given our current
vocabulary. Yeah, our current lexicon, as it were. Well, good on you, Catherine, and good on you for being a good parent. And thanks for calling into the program.
My pleasure, and thank you for the good fight.
You're welcome. Ivan in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Ivan, what's up?
Oh, nothing. I just wanted to add on the comment on the multiple parents is that it's actually Aldous Huxley in his later years wrote a lot of essays on multiple parenting, and he actually wrote about it being sort of like the future solution to education. He said that children having multiple parents to learn on and feed on lots of different points of view is actually contributed to society.
Yeah, Rudolf Steiner wrote about that as well, the founder of the Waldorf movement.
Yes,
and, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I come from a family of multiple parents. You know, my parents got divorced when I was 10. My mom had boyfriends, you know, throughout, which became like multiple dads.
Right.
And, you know, I learned a lot and stuff like that. So, yeah, definitely nothing wrong about that. In fact, I would say it's sort of like the future.
Yeah, well, the future is now, like they say in the Firesound Theater. So.
Well, you know, it's just kind of like renewable energy. It's going to be renewable parents.
There you go. Okay. Ivan, thanks a lot for the call. That's interesting. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Julian, you're going to call me out on something I said a couple days ago that was wrong, right?
I don't know if it was wrong or not. I was just curious. So.
Yeah, it's interesting. Lauren, our call screener, typed in is that you were asking, does the administration really practice astrology? And I had made that remark back last week, I think last Wednesday or Thursday, that the Bush administration was like the Reagan administration, was paying attention to things like Mercury retrograde. After I got off the air, I thought, you know, I'm not certain of that. I just think I've heard that, you know, and so I spent about a half hour Googling that, and I couldn't find any evidence of it. So, it's well known that Ronald Reagan used astrology and timed things based on astrology throughout his presidency. I haven't been able to find any evidence that George W. Bush does. So apparently I was wrong.
Well, I was hoping you were right, actually.
Well, I'm sorry.
Because the Christian right, you know, has pretty much anointed Bush as almost a messianic figure.
Yeah, I know.
If we showed them that he was practicing astrology.
Well, they had anointed Reagan as a messianic figure, and
right.
he never went to church at all, and he was following an astrologer. So, and he was divorced.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, go figure. This is where the Christian right, I don't call them Christians, I call them Christianists, and I don't think that they are practicing Christianity. I think they are practicing the application of a cult to politics. And I am a Christian. I am not a Christianist. I am very just like the Islamists. They want Islam to be not just the religion but also the state. And I think it's wrong. I just think it's wrong. And I think it's wrong for Christianists to do it, just like I think it's wrong for Islamists to do it. It's not good for us as a society. Laurie in San Francisco, California. Hey, Laurie, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. You had a caller earlier who said he was a recovering Republican.
Yeah.
And every
God bless him.
I'm sorry?
God bless him.
Yeah, really. And every time I hear one call, there's this little pause after they say, I'm a recovering Republican. Like they're waiting to hear, bravo, or how did you do that? And that's exactly what I would like to find out. I think that you need to do a show or a half hour of a show or something and ask recovering Republicans to phone in and tell what it was that made them wake up, because we need that information.
That's a great suggestion.
Yeah.
That is a great suggestion, although I can tell you by and large, you know, what the information is, and that typically it's that they came up against the realities of the world that the conservatives are preaching. You know, they lost their job and you know, there's this old joke that, you know, a conservative is a liberal who got older or something like that, or you know, whatever. And you know, a liberal is a conservative who lost his job. I mean, you know, there are all these cliches about it, but I suspect that there are two things. One is coming up face to face with the reality, the horrors and realities, you know, having to pay $20,000-$30,000 in medical bills and having them on your credit card and discovering that the administration doesn't give a damn, now that it's the Republican Party. I mean, those kinds of things cause people to leave the Republican Party.
But I'm thinking that what we need is to have their verbiage on it, their spin, their words.
Yeah.
Is what's going to help us be able to speak to other Republicans and say, hello.
Okay, yeah, indeed. Well, if there are any recovered Republicans out there, or recovering, you know, in the midst of the process, I actually have a 10 or 12 step program for recovering conservatives on my website. It's an article I wrote some time back. If you go to tomhartman.com and click articles on democracy, it's there. You know, how to recover from conservative talk radio, I think is the title. And number one, admit that you were a conservative and that you were wrong. and then it's harming the planet and it's harming everybody else. So it's a good idea, Laurie. It's a good idea. And my guess is that we'll probably over the next few days we'll have a trickle of callers sharing with us their stories.
Thanks.
Great to hear from you. Thank you very much. I've got to take a break here. 45 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program, telling the truths that the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about, and helping Republicans recover day by day. We'll be right back.
Now, I might be old-fashioned, but I believe it's true that folks around the world are pretty much like me and you. I have a silly notion if we want them to be friends, they prefer that we don't torture them. But I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
Unforgivable.
I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
He's your typical liberal.
And welcome back to the vast liberal conspiracy, or smack dab in the middle of it, here on the Tom Hartman radio program. 9.5 minutes past the hour, or before the hour. Before we go back to the phone calls here, let's just take a quick look at what's going on with the situation with the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know the men in the shadows of. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And they're alive in the balance.
The following are security and other developments in Iraq as of 1600 Greenwich Mean Time on Tuesday. This is from Reuters. Deadline Baghdad, mortar rounds rained down on several barrages on Andamiyah in northern Baghdad, killing 17 people and wounding 72, a police said. A doctor at the Numa'an Hospital put the death toll at 20. In Ballard Ruse, a suicide bomber killed at least 23 worshippers and wounded 57 others when he blew himself up in a Shiite mosque in that town. In Khan Anqin, at least 13 people, including 3 women, were killed and 39 wounded when a roadside bomb exploded by a procession of Shiites, marking the climax of the Ashura ceremony in that ethnically mixed town. In Baghdad, at least four Shiite pilgrims were killed and nine wounded when gunmen opened fire on two minibuses near the southern Baghdad district of Baia. In Mosul, a car bomb targeted a police patrol, killing two policemen and wounding two others. In Baghdad, police said a mortar round wounded nine pilgrims when it landed in Qadhimiya, a Shiite district in northern Baghdad, home to a revered shrine where thousands had gathered to commemorate Ashura. In Anbar province, a U.S. Marine died from wounds sustained in fighting in that area. In Baghdad, a total of 21 bodies were found in different areas of Baghdad on Monday. In Baghdad, the death toll from a mortar barrage on Monday in the southern Baghdad district of Za'afarani, if I'm pronouncing it right, rose to 16 people dead and 28 wounded, a police source said. Near Mawil, gunmen killed a teacher on Monday on the main road. And in Ramadi, a suicide truck bomber killed 16 people at the compound of a police rapid reaction force northwest of Ramadi, 68 miles west of Baghdad, on Sunday. In other developments, up to 2 million pilgrims commemorated a major annual event in the Shiite calendar, Ashura, in Karbala, as the event reached its climax. And in Najaf, the Iraqi Defense Ministry spokesman Mohammed al-Askari said the final toll from a battle on Sunday near Najaf was 263 dead. A total of 502, quote, soldiers of heaven, end quote, followers were arrested and 210 wounded. George W. Bush truly opened the gates of hell. Is it Pete Hund in Seattle, Washington? How do you pronounce that?
Pietun.
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 Pietun. Okay, great. Welcome.
I want to comment on the homosexual animals. There was a lizard, a big lizard. Do they call that Gila monster?
Yeah.
That was in a zoo, and it's a female, and she became pregnant. Mm-hmm. That happened last week, I think.
Right. And it wasn't a virgin birth. She was a hermaphrodite?
No. Well, this is a. The zoo was confused or as to how it could happen with there being no male around.
Right.
And also there is a magazine I read that shows mating worms equipped with male and female organs exchange sperm for external fertilization of eggs.
Right.
So that again is
So if you want to talk about nature's law, variety is the name of the game.
That's correct.
Correct. Well said. Thank you very much for the call. JR in Vancouver. Hey, JR.
Hello, Tom. I was interested by the conversation you were having about multiple parent homes. And I think that you can kind of see a correlation between being a liberal and a conservative based on that, because I think that you're more likely to be a liberal-minded individual if you are exposed to multiple ways of thinking, which is, obviously fostered by encountering more people. But if you're in a community or, say, in a single household that is strict and is not really bending to their surroundings or understandings, you're more likely to be a conservative.
It could be. There are some people that I know, some people that I've known throughout my life who were very wounded by their parents getting divorced, and that wounding caused them to become very rigid-minded people. So I'm not sure, I would never want to try to build the case that divorce gives kids access to multiple parents and that's a social good. I think that it's a crapshoot. It's a roll of the dice.
I think the bigger point isn't so much that the multiple households is what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
It's the exposure to different types of communication.
Right, and you can do that. You can do that whether or not those people are parents. Good point, JR. Dawn in Shoreline, Washington. Dawn, we have just a few seconds. You wanted to make a quick point.
Yes, I wanted to point out that when the bigots use the argument that this is the way it's always been in this country, they are absolutely wrong in point of fact. Before the Europeans arrived here, Native American tribes not only respected, honored, but sometimes gave very special privilege to gays and lesbians. In point of fact, the Apache Indians, for instance, have their well-known sun dance where warriors go through a rite of passage to become the warriors. The pole for the sun dance is always picked by a Bodesh warrior. That is a warrior who was born female.
Oh, interesting.
The male role. And oftentimes they will have wives and they will have children. When there have been children who've been orphaned, that's the family that takes
Dawn,
them
I have
in.
I have to wrap it up, but that's a great story. Thank you very much for calling and sharing that with us. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there. Get active. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.